Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and my guest today is a cartoonist, a historian, a biographer, a celebrated publisher, and founder of the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. He has authored or co-authored a teetering stack of books, including Underground Classics, The Transformation of Comics, Al Cap, A Life to the Contrary, The Art of Harvey Kurtzman, and this one that I have in my hand, The Oddly Compelling Art of Dennis Kitchen. Dennis Kitchen, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Well, thanks, Conch. I'm happy to be here.
So your first venture into self-publishing was back at the end of the 1960s when you were fresh out of the University of Wisconsin at Milwaukee, and you called your imprint Mom's Homemade Comics. How did you first get into comics? Was this a thing fresh out of diapers you were doing from the start?
Pretty much. You know, I knew from an early age, to me, comics were always fascinating, whether they were in the newspaper or comic books off the rack. I couldn't get enough of them, and I was drawing from an early age, and at a certain point got enough confidence that I thought, maybe I can do this. And so when I went to college in those days, there were no courses about comics and certainly no classes teaching comics. So I thought, well, maybe I'll major in art. Well, I found it very quickly. Art professors in those days looked down on comics about as far as you could look down on anything. So I quickly decided, well, I'm going to focus on journalism because half of being a cartoonist is writing, and I'll polish the writing side. And then I co-founded the first humor magazine that the University of Wisconsin in Milwaukee ever had, and that helped bolster confidence. So it just gradually evolved into a point when I got out of college, I said, I think I can do this.
And in 1970, you took Mom's Homemade Comics to the next step. It morphed into Kitchen Sink Press. And you were actually, at first, a collective of artists in Milwaukee. You had cheap, spacious digs above a laundromat. But a few years later, you moved the operation out to a rural setting. You actually ended up with a number of local creatives who loved coming together and producing this material.
Yeah, I was lucky. It shows you that there's a lot of talent everywhere. You just have to find it, attract it, coordinate it. I had some early skills, you know, editing, and I had a little business sense, which was more sense than most artists had. And I, by default, became the guy who was taking care of the business side, and that meant I, by default, became a publisher.
Yeah, well, you more than handled the business side. I mean, you became this very successful early underground publisher. You published stories by artists as wide-ranging as Trina Robbins and Robert Crumb.
Yeah, there's oil and water. Yeah, you know, I have to say, there was no business plan. It was moment by moment, week by week. I had certain taste. I certainly was someone who loved to look at a lot of different styles and stories and try to put together anthologies and encourage people. And I was lucky because at that time, there was such a demand for this sort of thing. Hippies were proliferating everywhere, and there were head shops everywhere, and the head shops were our bread and butter. We'd get a rack of comics in there, and they were just, you know, spinning it all day, and we didn't have to be geniuses to fill that market. And so we were so self-confident and full of ourselves then that we said, you know, we're not going to play by the rules. We don't ever want to work for the man. We're going to do our own comics, and nobody's going to tell us what to do. Nobody's going to censor us. We're going to keep our own art. We're going to keep our own copyright, etc. All those things were game changers. And normally it would have been laughable because the big companies were big because they had newsstand distribution. We distributed through a completely unorthodox method, which was primarily the head shops. And, you know, we also were sold through, you know, some bookstores, used bookstores, some university bookstores, and some mail order. We developed our own mail order division. And we felt we were part of something special. It's, you know, hindsight's easy now, but at the time we just knew we were turning comics on their head.
So Kitchen Sink Press really gained a reputation. And in fact, for 6 months in the mid-1970s, Marvel Comics, one of the big two, DC and Marvel, Marvel Comics experimented with underground publishing. The result was Comics Book, C-O-M-I-X. And that was a project you were asked to direct.
Yeah, that one evolved in a strange way. I had the temerity when I published my first Mom's Homemade Comics to send a copy to Stan Lee, because I had grown up enjoying the Marvel revival in the early 60s. I truly enjoyed them.
The Silver Age, they call it now.
Yeah, I mean, don't ask me to pick up a Marvel today, but back then, I thought they were great, and I just wanted to send Stan something as a fan who, I don't know, just want to kind of say thank you in a way. Here's a little gift, whatever, never expecting a reply. But I knew from his letters columns that he was fan-friendly. And I was pleasantly surprised. He had a nice personal note back encouraging me, saying something funny. And then I answered, not thinking I'd get a reply. And pretty soon, we were pen pals. And at one point, he called and he said, hey, we got an opening here. You want to come and work for Marvel? And part of me was like, oh, my God, that would be so cool. But I said, no, I'm really enjoying what I'm doing. I'm part of something that's my own entity. And, you know, thanks, but no thanks. And he was a little stunned because I don't think he'd ever offered a fanboy a job who turned him down. And that almost made him hungrier. So every few months we would talk and he would say, you know, so Mr. Big Shot in Milwaukee doesn't want to come to New York and work for Stan the Man. And I'd go, yeah. Yeah, again, thanks, Stan. I appreciate it. I'm flattered, but no. And then something finally developed, which was out of my control, which we called the Crash of 73. What happened was there was a Supreme Court decision. I think it was it Miller versus California? I forget offhand. Basically, the Supreme Court threw the definition of obscenity back to localities, which is kind of crazy because their reasoning was, well, you know, what's obscene in Podunk, Kansas might be different than what's obscene in New York or Los Angeles, whatever. But it just threw a lot of confusion. And what it really did was it put a real scare into places like head shops. Because here they are, already vulnerable, they're selling drug paraphernalia, they're probably not very welcome in most communities, and they've got a rack of things which arguably contain obscenity, depending on the eye of the beholder, right? So if you're a muckety-muck, you know, cop or prosecutor, you want to walk into a head shop and pull up a few things and say, this is obscene, you're under arrest. In essence, it caused a good number of shops to just stop carrying comics. So we were in a situation where our sales were really diminishing in a way that made us afraid we'd survive. And my partner at the time and I were wondering, you know, it's been a nice ride, but maybe it's over. And then Stan called, expecting the usual conversation, and he said, so I don't suppose you're interested in working for Marvel still? And I said, well, you know what? Let's talk. Maybe. So he flew me out to New York, and the result was the magazine.
Well, there were some pretty impressive names of artists who contributed to Comics Book. Harvey Pekar, Kim Deitch, Basil Wolverton, Howard Cruz, and it actually contained the first 3-page version of Art Spiegelman's Mouse.
Yeah, it gave it its first exposure, really. So yeah, it was fun. I mean, Trina told me later that she bought her house in San Francisco based on the money she made from Comics Book, and you know, that house now in San Francisco is probably worth $1 million. So it affected people's lives deeply. It also, for the first time, introduced underground cartoonists to a whole new audience that wasn't going into head shops, because this was sold on newsstands. You could find it in a drugstore or a place where magazines were sold. And I've been told many times over the years that's what turned on some young readers to this whole new breed of cartoonists and non-superhero stuff. So I don't regret it. It wouldn't have come about had we not had an economic crisis in the business.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Conser, and my guest today is author, archivist, biographer, publisher, and underground cartoonist Dennis Kitchen. Dennis was a longtime friend and collaborator of the legendary comics artist and writer Will Eisner, and has published dozens of Eisner's works. Yeah, let's talk about Will Eisner. He was one of the most prolific comics artists in history, and he started out creating stories as a teenager in the 1930s.
Yeah, literally as a teenager, when the comics business was just beginning. He was amazingly prolific, and he also was unusual in that he had, you know, both the right brain, left brain thing going. He was an astute businessman, just instinctively. Again, this is a guy who never had an education beyond high school. In fact, technically, he didn't graduate from high school because he didn't pass geometry, I think it was.
Well, that's interesting, since, I mean, he was the king of geometry in the comics
form. Yeah, it is ironic, isn't it? But again, it just it shows you, you know, what innate talent can overcome. Also, again, the opportunity, kind of like I was able to be at the ground floor of something because of circumstances and timing, so was he in a different era. In my case, I got to at least see the work of the generation that came before me. In his case, he was building the building blocks. There were no comic books. There had been newspaper strips, of course, since the 1890s, and they were hugely popular. But comic books were really the invention of a printer who just saw an opportunity to take popular newspaper comics and fold them to a smaller size and sell them on newsstands, and that proved to be a successful venture. And so they began doing more of those, and at a certain point they were running out of newspaper strips. So Will was in an industry that suddenly needed a lot of original material.
Well, Will Eisner, I mean, he's best known for The Spirit, which is the long-form newspaper comic that just bent all the rules of the art form. But, you know, himself, just Eisner was so far ahead of his time. The Spirit was really a hybrid of the newspaper comic and the comic book.
It was. It was a one-of-a-kind. Hybrid is the right word. If you're local newspaper carried it, and you'd open your Sunday paper and it would fall on your lap. It's kind of a free comic book.
It was also a hybrid of the detective novel and the superhero comic.
Yeah, the syndicate wanted some kind of a superhero. Will didn't want to do superhero. He gave the character a mask and on kind of a flimsy premise. You know, he never liked it. For him, it was all about telling stories, and in a lot of the stories, the spirit is rather incidental. He's on the sidelines, or it's really stories about other characters, because that's what he saw his role, his entire career, being a storyteller. He told me when he joined the National Cartoonist Society early on, he was the token comic book guy, because these were the newspaper strip artists.
But because, and editorial cartoonists as well.
Yeah, but comic book guys weren't welcome, but because his comic book was inserted in a newspaper, he kind of got in on a technicality. And so he got to know people like Al Capp and Milton Caniff and, Rube Goldberg, all the giants of the day. And he told me when he would be, this basically was a social club. They'd have their club meetings at a bar in New York and shoot the bull. And whenever he would try to get serious and talk about the potential of comics, he said they would just look at him askance and they would just really furrow their eyebrows. And he said Rube Goldberg told him one time, "Young man, we're just here to sell newspapers. Don't get so uppity," or something to that effect. They saw themselves as entertainers. And Will saw it as more than that. And that's why, by the time I finally met him in 1971, he had heard about underground comics, hadn't seen them, but he had heard the business model was very different and was very open, and there were really no guidelines. They were distributed different, artists were paid different, all these things. And so he was intensely curious, and he sought me out at a time when I was a virtual nobody, and he was a legend already.
Now, as amazing a relationship as you had with Will Eisner, his first introduction to underground comics was not auspicious. And this was back in the early 70s where you first met at, was it the Chicago Comic Convention?
No, this was the Commodore Hotel in New York City. It was a Phil Suling convention. First one I had ever been at. And we were both kind of new to the idea of fans descending in a hotel and tables full of back issues and just stuff that, you know, was an exciting new invention in itself. So, yeah, he, through an intermediary, he sought me out on the floor, and I was even skeptical. A Frenchman named Maurice Horn, who was a comics historian, who had actually put together the first comics exhibit at the Louvre, of all places, he saw me. I must have a badge with my name or something, and he said, in his French accent, "Mr. Will Eisner, he wants to meet you." And I was sure that there was a language problem or some misunderstanding, and I said, I don't know Mr. Eisner. I don't think he's looking for me. And he said, no, he insisted I come with him. And sure enough, what had happened was Will knew about undergrounds, and Phil Suling, the impresario, had told him enough that made him curious. But after he peppered my brain with all these questions, he admitted he hadn't actually seen any, and he said he'd like to. And so we went down to the floor and went to a section where there were two or three tables full, all face up. And I was going to select one or two to show him, but he just impulsively grabbed one, and it was, I think, Zap number 2. But I know the page. It was Captain Pickums by S. Clay Wilson. And it wasn't just, you know, I mean, Wilson is dangerous anyway, but this was one where
he was the creator of the Checkered Demon, which was notorious.
Yeah, Wilson's the one who taught Crumb how to draw dirty. So he was the epitome of the outrageous outskirts of what underground comics were doing. So, yeah, I don't even know if, you know, you want your radio audience to even know what it was Will saw, but it shocked him. And after a short conversation, I think he showed his generational shock. Basically said to me, I had no idea they were this graphic. And I tried to explain that this was a bit of an extreme, that there were all kinds of underground comics. Just because they were uncensored didn't mean everyone went to the extremes. But
then you were interrupted by a very young Art Spiegelman.
Yeah, he happened to be there when he was basically a nobody, and he just happened to pick up on the conversation and argue in defense of S. Clay Wilson, which didn't help matters. And so after the three of us had this short and vigorous discussion, Will excused himself, and I was confident I would never see him again. And I was kind of annoyed that Art had, you know, made it worse. But the good news is I had kept Will's business card. And in those pre-digital days, I wrote him a letter and said how happy I was to meet him, and I enjoyed our conversation. I said, "I'm sorry you picked up a comic you found offensive." So I said, "I'm enclosing half a dozen or so that I think show a broader array of what's out there, and maybe you'll find them worthwhile." And a bit later, I got a letter back, and he thanked me very much. And he said, yes, he had enjoyed those, and he'd like to talk further. So that was the kind of interesting beginning. Could have gone real bad, but it was one of the other things I found about Will was he was open to what a younger generation was doing in a way that I found very, very few of his contemporaries were interested. The other old-timers, they were interested in other old-timers, you know. They were interested in the stuff they had done their whole career. They weren't interested in what these long-haired kids were doing. Why would they? But Will did.
Well, it was a welcome development all around that you and Will Eisner developed a friendship, because it was working with you that he developed really the long-form comic story, and he was the first artist to call his work a graphic novel.
Right. I always put an asterisk on it because there was a fanzine that used that term, and historians will always point to that. But
Ironically, he preferred the term sequential art when talking about comics.
But Contract with God did on the cover say graphic novel, and it was the first one to declare itself that, and that's the name that caught on. And to me, he's the guy who started the whole revolution. And there had been some forerunners. I always like to point out Harvey Kurtzman's Jungle Book, because that was a big, big influence on me and a lot of the other undergrounders. That came out in 1959, and it was wonderful. But it flopped, totally flopped. And so when Contract with God came along, it benefited from the fact that by 1978 we had comic shops, we had organized fandom. The fact that fans were talking to each other, reviewing things, criticizing things, there was a chance, on a small scale, what today you'd say going viral. Before that, when Harvey did Jungle Book, you didn't know the fan that might have been on the other side of town. How would you ever find out? There was no comic shop to meet him at. There was no fanzine. There was no internet. There were just little isolated pockets of fandom. So Will benefited from that, but still, inherently, it was just something very special. And you had a guy who was already a master of comic art suddenly doing this semi-autobiographic work about people that seemed very real. And they didn't wear capes, and they didn't have superpowers. It was just gritty stories about New York and the Depression. And as obvious it seems now, it seems so obvious, why can't comics be fatter? Why can't they have a spine? Why can't they be like real books? But it took someone like Will Eisner to make it happen then. I think inevitably it would have happened, but he was there first.
And the Eisner Awards are considered the Oscars of the comics industry. They've been given out at the San Diego Comic-Con since 1988, when Will was still with us.
Yeah, it was cool because he would be on stage. So if you got to walk up on stage and get it, he would hand it to you. So yeah, it was a good experience. It just brought it all full circle. I just thought it was a wonderful thing that he lived long enough to be the Oscar and to get some adulation while he could still appreciate it. Because for many years, he worked in virtual anonymity, you know. Might have had fans, but in those days you didn't see your fans. It's not like you're a musician and you hear the applause. If you're a cartoonist, you don't hear the applause.
I know you have a busy schedule, but before you go, I wanted to ask you about the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund. The current head of the CBLDF is Charles Brownstein, who's a friend of yours and a friend of the show, but you were really the founder.
Yeah, I mean, again, I never realized at the time that it would turn into this venerable organization. At the time, what happened was I was a publisher still in Wisconsin, and I got a call from a retailer in suburban Chicago who said the cops had come in and busted one of his shops and arrested the manager, confiscated a dozen or so titles, and one of them was one that I published called Omaha the Cat Dancer, which was an anthropomorphic kind of a soap opera, but it had erotic elements. And I certainly didn't think it was pornographic by any means. It was erotic, but it was literate. And I was indignant. And I said, what's going to happen? And he said, well, yeah, I just wanted to let you know. He said, I hired an attorney, and hopefully it'll go away. What happened was he hired an attorney who really was just a general lawyer, didn't have any special skills with First Amendment issues. They had an expert witness who botched things. Everything went wrong, and the manager was convicted and was facing some months in jail and a big fine. And at that moment, I got really angry that this could happen, that this kind of a basic violation of the First Amendment in the medium I loved. And so I told him, I said, I'm going to raise some money. We got to get a top-rate attorney to overturn this. And so the first thing I did was approach a lot of the artists I knew who had big followings, starting with like Sergio Aragonés and Robert Crumb and Will Eisner. And I think I got a dozen different artists, and I got my printer to print it at cost. I got distributors at the time to agree to not pass along their profit, basically to get as much money as possible from this. And fans were very supportive. So with the money from that, I found an attorney, Bert Joseph, in Chicago, who had been basically Hugh Hefner's attorney. And I said, we need to overturn this case. And so he was able on a technicality to overturn it, because you know, it's hard. You have to find some flaw in the original one. So once he overturned it and the manager was off the hook and we felt vindicated, I still had at that point, I think, somewhere in between $10,000 and $20,000 in the bank. And it wasn't my money. I'd raised it for this cause. So at that point, I decided, well, I either have to give it to another charity, or maybe there'll be another case or two like this, and we should just, you know, have a permanent organization. And the money we were raising would be used to pay a first-rate attorney to defend you. And that's how it started in 1988, I think. And now a good part of that work is educational. Again, it's headquartered in Portland, so Portland can be proud. It's got another great nonprofit. Charles travels over the country speaking about it, and the good work continues. Any of your listeners who are sympathetic and don't know about it, you go online, find out about it.
Yeah, how could people support the comic book?
Can support it literally with donations. You can become a member. I would just say go online.
Yeah, what's the website for the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund?
CBLDF.com.
All right. And if listeners want to find out more about your work, well, Kitchen Sink Press is no longer with us, but more recently you've been collaborating with designer John Lind and Dark Horse founder Mike Richardson. You launched a new imprint called Kitchen Sink Books.
Yes, we do a couple of books a year on subjects that are near and dear to our heart. The one I mentioned about Contract with God, the deluxe, we call it the Curator Collection. We talked about the Marvel Experiment Comics book earlier. We did a collection of that. We did Harvey Kurtzman's Jungle Book in a deluxe edition, that sort of thing.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And my guest today has been author, artist, comics publisher, and historian, Dennis Kitchen. Dennis, thanks so much for joining us in the studio today.
No problem. My pleasure. Carry on.
And many thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. You can find an archived version of the show later today at KBOO.FM/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @WordsAndPicture.